Okay, well, let's go ahead and turn to 1 Kings, chapter number 15. 1 Kings, chapter 15. And we've been in a study looking at lessons from the kings of Israel, or the kings of Israel and Judah. And we're kind of jumping back and forth between Kings and Chronicles. In Kings, you find much more of a focus on Israel, the northern kingdom. And in Chronicles, you find more of a focus on Judah, the southern kingdom. And really, in Kings, the only time that you're going to read about Judah, the southern kingdom, is whenever they come in contact with the northern kingdom. And in Chronicles, the only time you're going to read about the northern kingdom is when they come in contact with the southern kingdom. And so that's kind of the way that works. And so the past few weeks, we've been in Chronicles because we've been looking at the southern kingdom. We've been looking at Judah. And as we went into this study, we've talked about in the divided kingdom, there is, I can't remember the exact number, which one was which. I think there was 20 kings in Israel and 19 in Judah, or either that or the other way around. Can't remember. One way or the other, but it's close enough. And in Israel, they had no good kings. And in Judah, they only had about 8 that were good. And of those 8, only about 4 or 5 of them was really good. And they had a few revivals that happened during the time there. And so that allowed them to stay in the land for about 100 years more than what Israel did. But that's what we've been seeing as we go along in this. But I've said from the beginning, one of our main reasons for looking at this is lessons that we can learn from them. Because as kings, they were kind of highlighted in their walk with God, or the lack thereof, and the results of that. They were leading people and leading them either to do good or to do evil. And for us in our lives, we have influence on people, and it allows us to see in our lives how we live, how we relate to God has an effect on people around us. And so that's kind of why we've been looking at this. So last week, what we were looking at, Abijah and Asa, kings of Judah. And Abijah was known as being a bad king, not because he was outright wicked, but because he was just mediocre. He didn't seek after God, but he also didn't pursue after wickedness either. He just kind of floated along. He just kind of coasted. And so God judged him, since he was a leader, since he was a king, and he did not lead the people to do right. He did not pursue after God. So he was a bad king. Okay? But after him, his son Asa was known to be a good king. Asa actually pursued after God. Asa led the people in reforms. He led the people in worship. He led the people to serve God. He cleared out idolatry. He got rid of different things that was unpleasing to God. And he encouraged the people to serve God. In that, he was a good king. And he reigned for quite a long time. He was a king for 41 years. And during that time, he had peace for the first 10, used that to do some reforms, to build up his kingdom, to build up the defenses and things. After 10 years, the Ethiopians came against him, and he cried out to God, led the people to cry out to God, and God gave them a great victory, right? And then a little while later in his kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel, led by Baasha, which we're going to read about tonight, learn about tonight, the northern kingdom ended up starting to build fortifications on the border and trying to limit people's travel between the north and the south. And as a result, Asa was getting a little bit older. He had had a significant amount of time of peace, and throughout all of that, he began to wane in his trust of God. His faith began to waver because of complacency, because of being in relative ease, that he didn't necessarily have to depend on God so much. And so whenever he started feeling threatened by Israel, instead of pursuing after God and seeking God, he ended up buying off the Syrians. The Syrians had an alliance with Israel. And so Asa took the riches from the temple and from the palace and things, gave it to Syria and said, here, we're allies now. Go and turn your back on Israel that's been your ally. By the way, if you're able to get someone to turn on that person, they're going to turn on you as well, right? That's just the way it goes. If they're going to betray that person for you, they'll betray you for someone else. But anyway, he paid them to betray the northern kingdom, and they did. And God sent a prophet to him and said, if you would have trusted in me, I would have defeated your enemy and I would have gave you victory over the Syrians as well. But now, since you have done this and not trusted in me, this is going to become a constant problem for your nation. And he persecuted the prophet that came and gave him the message, threw him in jail, persecuted the others that were critical of his foreign policy. And then in his old age, it says that he was diseased in his feet, and he still would not seek after God in his old age. And so our lesson that we learn from Asa, though he was a good king, though he had led the people to serve God and follow God, in the end of his life, he had grown apathetic, he'd grown lukewarm and cold toward God. And because of that, he did not finish well. And that's an encouragement for us as Christians not to allow ourselves, our zeal, our fervor to wane as we get older, not to allow complacency to set in, not to allow our long time of service to end up dropping off just because it has been a long time. And so we want to desire, like the Apostle Paul, we need to finish our course and finish well. And so Asa is a cautionary tale in that. The other thing that I brought out from Asa is I believe that part of the reason why he didn't pursue God whenever he was diseased in his feet, whenever he persecuted the man of God, I believe a lot of it was because of his shame and his guilt and his discouragement of himself. Because that's what happens to us a lot of times. Whenever we blow it, it's hard for us in our pride to admit that we blowed it. And instead we sulk, we get angry, we lash out at other people, and we tend to not turn to God and admit our mistakes and get those right. We do like Adam and Eve did in the garden and hide from God. And I think that's what Asa was doing at the end of his life, is that he messed up and he was hiding from God. And we don't want to do that. So tonight what we're going to be looking at is we're going to be going back to the northern kingdom. We're going back to Israel. And I'm trying to keep this from getting confusing, okay? Because if you go through Kings and Chronicles, you're constantly jumping back and forth. Northern kingdom, southern kingdom, northern, southern, northern, southern, right? And I don't want us to get confused in this. So as I'm jumping back and forth, I'm trying to keep them separated. And so we're going from Rehoboam's household, Rehoboam and Abijah and Asa, to Jeroboam's household in the north. Okay? And this is going to cover the same amount of time as Asa's reign. So Asa reigned for 41 years. We said that a minute ago. And so what was going on up north while he was reigning? What happened in his 41 years? Asa was a good king. The people of Judah were growing in their walk with God. The temple worship was going on. There were good things happening there, but what was going on in Israel? And that's where things really get messy, because what was going on in Israel was a mess. It was problem after problem, and we'll see that tonight. And the thing that kept coming to my mind as I was studying this, I was comparing it, instead of two different nations, I was comparing it to two different people. We could almost compare it to Jacob and Esau. We could compare it to even maybe family members that we know of, because you have two different, because, you know, Israel and Judah, they are family, right? But they are going in two different directions. They have chosen two different paths. And you can compare the two of them and see how it pans out for them. And so while Asa is ruling in Judah, he didn't rule perfectly, but none of the kings did, right? But while Asa is ruling in Judah and he is doing well and the people are serving God in Israel, in the northern kingdom, it is backstabbing. It is political unrest. It is constant turmoil. it is all sorts of problems going on over here. And really, it is a, I guess we can compare it to, is a slippery slope that you just keep sliding deeper and deeper into the mire of ungodliness. And that's what the Northern Kingdom is doing. And so let's look in, let's see here, verse number 25 of 1 Kings chapter 15. And we're going to find Jeroboam's son. It says, verse 25, "And Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned over Israel 2 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the sin wherewith he made Israel to sin. And Baasha, the son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, conspired against him. And Baasha smote him at Gibeathon, which belonged to the Philistines, for Nadab and all Israel laid siege in Gibeathon. Even in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, did Baasha slay him and reigned in his stead. And it came to pass when he reigned that he smote all the house of Jeroboam. He left not to Jeroboam any that breathed until he had destroyed him, according to the saying of the Lord, which he spake by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite, because of the sins of Jeroboam which he sinned, and which he made Israel sin, by his provocation wherewith he provoked the Lord, God of Israel, to anger. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Israel?" So as we come to Jeroboam's son, we know that Jeroboam was a wicked king. And every king that reigns over Israel from this time forward is always compared to Jeroboam. In the northern kingdom, or excuse me, in the southern kingdom of Judah, they're always compared to David, right? No. But in the northern kingdom, they're always compared to Jeroboam. David is the picture of what the king is supposed to be. And so he is the measuring stick. He is, they did not according to the ways of David, their father, or they did. Okay? But Jeroboam is the measuring stick for evil. Because Jeroboam was afraid. He didn't trust God's promises to him. And he started an entire false religion and led the entire country in following a false religion and turning away from God and turning away from his commandments and turning away from his temple and his priesthood and all of those things. Jeroboam did all of that. And as a result, God had sent a prophet to Jeroboam and told him that judgment was coming upon him. And we discussed that back several weeks ago. And God says, "Jeroboam, because of your wickedness, you are not going to have a dynasty. You're not going to continue reigning, and you're going to die, and all of your children are going to die." Says, as a matter of fact, not even going to be buried. They're going to be laid out on the face of the earth for the dogs and the birds to eat. And that is the judgment that's going to come because of your wickedness. And so what we're seeing here is his heir, Nadab, is taking the throne after Jeroboam dies. And whenever he takes the throne, he rules for a very short amount of time. He rules less than 2 years, and the prophecy is fulfilled. And he is killed by Baasha, which was one of the, is one of, more than likely, one of the military men that was, should have been serving under him. Staged a coup, came in, killed him. Okay? And so whenever he killed him, he killed not only him, but he killed his entire household, which was what was prophesied. And the reason why he would kill the entire household wasn't just because of the prophecy. The reason he killed the entire household was he didn't want anyone who could contest his kingdom, any other claims to the throne. And this was a common practice in that place at that time in the Eastern cultures. If there was someone who took the throne, they would wipe out all of the heirs that could possibly lay claim to the throne. Whenever David took over the throne from Saul, he didn't do that. Because if it was up to culture and what culture dictated, he would have killed all of Saul's family, including Mephibosheth, right? Right. But instead, David was looking for someone from the house of Saul to show kindness to, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's where David went against the culture. And so just because something is culturally accepted doesn't make it right.
Exactly.
And so anyway, what we find here is that Baasha comes and he decides to stage a coup against the king. And he goes in, slays him, slays all of his family. And God's prophecy is fulfilled. His judgment is handed down. Now, whenever we were talking about this prophecy and this judgment, we discussed for quite a while about how God would issue judgment and it would go on to the children, right? I believe Peter was here, we were talking about that. And so we're talking about how it goes to the children and different things. But what we find in this is that, I guess two things that I want to bring out is this child, Nadab, was following in his father's footsteps. It wasn't the thing that the father did evil and the son reaped the consequences of it, but the father did evil, the son followed him in doing evil, and the consequences were just because he continued in that wickedness. Not only that, but something that we see in this is that a lot of times God's judgment is passive. Okay? And what I mean by that, God's judgment being passive, is that God doesn't actually have to do anything for it to come. Mm-hmm. The difference is active and passive. And my girls will probably roll their eyes at this because they study active and passive tense in English. Yeah. Okay? But whenever I say that his judgment is passive, all he has to do is not restrain the evil.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't realize how much God actually does, how much he restrains, how much he protects, how much he hedges about. We can look at Job for an example. In Job's life, God and Satan are having their conversation, and he says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan says, "Oh, yes, I've considered him, but I can't touch him. You won't let me." Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And he says, "But if you will take your hand off of him, then he will curse you to your face." Remember the whole conversation? And so God takes his hand off of him, takes his hedge of protection out from around Job for a minute. And as soon as that hedge is removed, Satan does as much as he can to wreck Job's life as God will allow. Right? So whenever we look at the northern kingdom, whenever we look at Jeroboam, his children, and the family that follows after, we find that they are going contrary to God. Not just contrary, but they're going against God. They don't want to follow God. They want nothing to do with God. They are living wickedly. And so basically they're saying, "God, I don't need you." And God obliges. God says, "If you don't need me, fine then. I'll just step back." And as soon as he steps back, as soon as his restraint is gone, what happens? Well, Satan is there with his emissaries working about wreaking havoc over the nations. And so as soon as God removes his hand of protection and allows Satan there, Satan is going about seeking whom he may destroy, right? So Satan raises up a man by the name of Baasha to come against Nadab and to destroy him, and not just destroy him, but go into an entire regicide, getting rid of the entire royal family, killing them all. And so essentially what's happening is God is not actively moving Baasha against him. He's just no longer preventing those who would come against him, preventing them from doing it. And that's what I'm talking about with a passive judgment. And I think that's what happens a lot of times whenever we make it clear to God that he's not welcome, that we don't want him, that we don't need him, that we've got it under control. I think there's sometimes that he just steps back and says, "Okay," and he leaves us to it. And whenever that happens and he is no longer restraining the evil, when he is no longer restraining the enemy, then we are open to those attacks and the natural consequences of our decisions kick in and cause us all kinds of misery and heartache and hurt because we've said, "God, I don't need you. I'm going my own way." Even in our service to God, I think we get it wrong a lot of times and we think that we are doing things in order to earn God's favor and earn God's blessing, when in reality, the things that God has said in his word and the way that he lays out in his word for us to live, the way that he says is good, that is the path to blessing. He says, "If you walk in my statutes, if you keep my statutes and you keep my way, the natural consequence, the natural result of these things is going to be these blessings. It's not that because I was such a good boy, I get a gold star. You know, it wasn't because I'm doing so good at this that God is rewarding me. It's that if I'm following God's pathway, if I'm following the way that God leads me, then the natural results are going to be blessing. But if I go against God, then the natural results are going to be cursing. Even the nation of Israel, whenever they came out of Egypt and God was leading them through the wilderness and bringing them into the promised land, they came to a place where the people were divided between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, I think, if I remember correctly. And from one mountain, they read the blessings, and the other mountain, they read the cursings. Do you guys remember that?
Yes.
Some of you do? Okay. And so this was their reminder before they went in the promised land. If you walk this way, blessings follow. If you walk this way, curses follow. And it's not necessarily God actively doing one or the other. He's saying you go this route, good things happen. You go this route, bad things happen. We were talking a little bit before church started. We're talking about diets and whatnot, the things that you eat. If you eat healthy, you're going to have a better weight. You're going to have more energy. You're going to feel better. You eat bad, your weight's going to go up. You're going to have less energy. You're going to feel bad.
Yeah.
Okay? And so that's just the natural results of the decisions that we're making. And so as we're seeing with these kings, they are making decisions either to pursue after God and do the things that are right, or to pursue after evil and to do the things that are wrong. And there are consequences that are loaded into either one of them. If they say, God, I need you, God comes and he will wipe out the entire army, though, that they are twice the size of them, right? We saw that happen under the one king. God defeated an army twice his size. But if we say, God, we don't need you, we're going to get defeated by an army that is a third of our size. Right? That's just what happens because we don't realize how much we actually do need and depend on him. And so that was King Nadab here. Something interesting that I want to bring out from him as well is in verse 26, he did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father. He walked in the ways of his father. There's a principle that we find all the way through Scripture, and especially through the kings that we're going to be reading about, is how much of an impact, how much of an impact the parents make on their children. We are all individually responsible for the decisions we make. My children will give an account for themselves. They're all individually responsible for the decisions that they make. And so if they decide one of these days to turn their back on all the things that they've been taught and the way that they've been raised, they're accountable for that, right? But the parents' direction has a great impact on how the children turn out. Whenever we look at Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, very familiar passage of Scripture, train a child up in the way he should go, and when he is old, he'll not depart from that. We have talked about that just, I think, this past Sunday, that it is a proverb, not a promise. Okay? Because everyone has their own free will. Everyone can make decisions and choices. And so you can do everything right, and the child can still go astray. But generally speaking, if you train them up in the way they should go, they will keep with it. But the opposite is also true. And if you train them up in the way they ought not to go, they're going to maintain that course as well, generally. Does that mean that a kid that comes from a bad home life and a bad family is just doomed for their life? No, they can depart from that just the same as a kid from a good family can depart from that. Everyone has their own responsibilities there. But as a general principle, parents have a huge impact on how their children turn out. And like I said, we see that all the way through the Scripture here. And so why did he live evil? Why did he forsake the ways of God? Because that's what he saw as an example from his father. That's the way that his father walked, and he walked in the same way as his father. A joke around our house is the whole idea of being just like your parent. Okay? And there's been plenty of people down through the years that have said, I don't want to be like my mom. I don't want to be like my dad. And the next thing you know, they are just like them. Goes back to the saying, more is caught than is taught, right?
Yeah.
And so if we want to say we have a bad raising, there's bad things going on, then it takes us actively doing something to get rid of that, to cleanse us from that, because it is programmed into us, right?
Right.
And so with Nadab, he followed the way of his father. Something I didn't bring out as we were looking at the kings of Judah in 2 Chronicles chapter 12 and chapter 13, we find twice where it talks about their mothers. It talks about the mother of Rehoboam, talks about the mother of the one that came after him, I think maybe Abijam. And their mothers were, Rehoboam's mother was a Jew, but Abijam's mother was a Gentile. Okay? And the reason why the Bible is pointing these things out is saying that it's not just the father that's responsible, but it's the mother as well. Both parents have a part in how the children turn out. And so this is a lesson for us as Christians, is that we need to take seriously for parents how we raise our kids, and for those who don't have kids, who the parents of their children are going to be. So one of these days, whenever they get older, whenever they get married, they need to be paying attention, not just to how they look or how they smell or how they make me feel. It's how are they going to parent the children. So maybe that's, with this crowd, maybe that's more for my kids. I don't know. Hopefully they'll listen. We shall see. But anyway, I better move on. I'll get in trouble. So as we come down to what Baasha does here in verse 27 and following, it says that Nadab and the armies are besieging Gibeathan. Okay? They're besieging Gibeathan, and I want to bring this out because it's going to come back. It's going to recur. But if you look back in the book of Joshua, Gibeathan was actually part of the land of Israel. It was a Levitical city. So it was a city that was given to the Levites. But now we find that Israel is trying to win Gibeathan back. Hopefully everybody's still following me on this. Okay? Gibeathan was supposed to be part of Israel. It belonged to the Levites, but now the Philistines have it. I believe it's Philistines, right? Okay. So now the Philistines have it, and Nadab is coming and bringing his armies, laying siege against it, trying to win it back. How did the Philistines end up with it? Anyone want to take a guess? It belonged to the Levites. What happened to the Levites in Israel? They left. They got booted out whenever Jeroboam put them out of the priesthood and put his own priest in, right? And so whenever the Levites left, this city was left vacant, and it was prime for the enemy to move in and to take it over. Okay? And so now, because of the things that they have done, because of them putting away the Levites, putting away the people of God, and leaving that vacuum there, the enemy moved in, possessed it, and they're having trouble getting rid of them. And so the lesson for us in this, if we're not careful in our Christian lives, there is areas that we give up to the enemy. There are things that we let down our guard on, or we allow the enemy to come in and possess. And whenever we do that, we're going to be a long time trying to evict them. Because whenever Satan gets a foothold in our life, he's about like weight that's gained. Okay? You know how it's a lot easier to gain weight than it is to get rid of it? It's January. This is a good example. Okay? Weight is a lot easier to gain than it is to lose. And Satan is the same way. It's a lot easier for there to become sinful strongholds in your life. It's a lot easier for those things to creep in than it is to get rid of them. And so because Jeroboam allowed sin and wickedness to come in and push God out of there, it allowed there to be enemies there that continue to be a problem, and they couldn't get rid of them. And so they are laying siege to the city. They're trying to gain back the ground that they had lost, and they aren't making very good progress. We're going to find out some years later they are still laying siege to the city. Okay? At the end of Baasha's reign, They're still laying siege to the city. Still haven't reclaimed it. So we have to be really careful giving up any ground to Satan, because anything that we give to him, we're going to have trouble getting back. Anything we give to the flesh, any places that we allow sin to creep in, it's going to be hard to reclaim that. Okay? And so anyway, back to what we're looking at here. That's in verse 27. And so Baasha slew him, reigned in his stead. He fulfilled the prophecies. Just as a bit of a note here, just because he fulfilled the prophecy doesn't mean he was doing the will of God. Doesn't mean that God sanctioned what he was doing. It was God said, because of your wickedness, these things are going to happen to you. And whoop, there it did. Right? And so it's not that God is coming down to Baasha and saying, hey, Baasha, I want you to come. I want you to be treacherous and do an act of treason, throw a coup here and end up stealing the throne. But God took his hand away and that opened up the door for Baasha to come in. And he did that. And so he slew it all, slew all of the king's family, took over the reign. And we come down to verse 32. And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. In the third year of Asa of Judah, began Baasha, to the son of Ahijah, to reign over all Israel in Tirzah, 24 years. And so this guy that comes and stole the kingdom actually had a fairly long reign, 24 years. And so now we have two different kings reigning during the time of Asa. We have Nadab, and he is betrayed and killed, all of his family. Now we have Baasha ruling during the time of Asa. In verse 34 says, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of Jeroboam, and in the sin where he made Israel to sin. And so this is interesting to me. Why did Jeroboam and Nadab, why did their dynasty not continue? Why did it come to an end? Y'all fall asleep on me? Why did God end Jeroboam's reign? Okay, so because of his wickedness, right? He did not go in the ways of God. He caused Israel to sin. He made the golden calves. He did all those things, right? And so God says, because of this, I'm going to allow your kingdom, your dynasty, to come to an end. So Baasha comes. And if you had been Baasha, would you see fit to do things a little bit differently? Would you look at Jeroboam and Nadab and say, the only reason I'm reigning is because they did evil and God allowed them to be destroyed? And so I don't want to do evil. I don't want my dynasty to be destroyed. I want to continue in this place, so I'm going to do things right. Wouldn't that be the best way to go about it? But Baasha did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam. So in other words, Jeroboam messed up, went against God, was judged for it. Baasha didn't learn. He did the exact same things. And you play stupid games, you get stupid prizes, right? And so if Jeroboam did it and it caused him to be destroyed, Baasha does it, what's going to happen to him? Same thing. And this is something that we talk about and say, well, if I was Baasha, I would do it differently. Really? Would we? How many times is there things within our lives, how many times is there things within our culture that we can clearly see has negative results in people's lives, and yet we think we'll be the exception? You know, how many people are getting involved in drugs and alcohol and promiscuity and things like that, and they see the negative results, they see the pain, the heartache, the addiction, the all the things that happen, and yet people continue to get into those things. For some reason, our flesh continues running into it. I believe our flesh, our heart, our desires are self-destructive. And so we don't learn. We don't learn from the mistakes of others, and if we're smart, we will. That's one reason we're learning from the kings while we're looking at lessons from the kings, right? Is we're seeing the things that they did, the way that it turned out. And so they're following after their own heart. They're living a mediocre life. They're playing games with God. And they get in a mess. And then we don't really learn from that. And we end up doing the same thing. Or we see the good kings and we say, hey, they pursued after God and they cried out to him for help and they trusted him and God worked mightily for them. And then we don't follow their examples. But if we're wise, we will. We'll learn these lessons. We had a talk at home not too long ago about how the lessons that we learn ourselves tends to stick with us better than learning from other people. That we learn by our mistakes. But the mistakes that we learn from personally hurt a lot more than learning from somebody else's mistakes, right? And so whenever we come down to Baasha, he does the exact same thing as those before him. And so we come down to chapter number 16. Just as Jeroboam, God sends a prophet to Baasha. And it says, then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, forasmuch as I exalted thee out of the dust and made thee prince over my people Israel, and thou hast walked in the way of Jeroboam and has made my people Israel to sin to provoke me to anger with their sins. Behold, I will take away the posterity of Baasha and the posterity of his house, and will make thy house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Him that dieth of Baasha in the city shall the dogs eat, and him that dieth of his in the fields shall the fowls of the air eat. Now the rest of the acts of Baasha and what he did and his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Israel? So Baasha slept with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah. And Elah, his son, reigned in his stead. And also by the hand of the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, came the word of the Lord against Baasha and against his house, even for all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord, in provoking him to anger with the work of his hands, in being like the house of Jeroboam, and because he killed him. And so why did God's judgment come upon Baasha? Because he didn't learn from the mistakes of Jeroboam. He continued in his sin. And not only did he continue in his sin, he was also guilty of murdering him. He just did the same things as Jeroboam. And to add to that, he had a murder on top of it. And so God said, you're going to get the same treatment that Jeroboam got. You're going to die, you're going to be buried, and then your dynasty is going to be done away with. And as I said earlier in this, it's not that God is actively going out and bringing people in and having prophets to go. I know there's places where he says, okay, a prophet's going to go talk to this guy, and then this guy is going to go and do what the prophet says. That's not what happens. These guys are just going their own way. They're just following their own passions. They're fulfilling their own lusts. If it wasn't Baasha, if it wasn't the next guy, then it'd be somebody else that wants to stage a coup, that wants to get a throne, that wants to get in power. It's just that God removes his hand and he allows it. What God told him here in, verse number 2, I exalted thee of the dust and made thee prince over my people Israel. God has a way of taking one man down, setting another one up. And if we're looking on it from an outside perspective, if we don't have the Bible setting there and laying it out for us, it just looks like the natural process of time, doesn't it? If it wasn't for God saying, I have judged you and I am going to bring about this destruction on your household, it just looks like, well, there was someone that was more powerful than Nadab, came in and killed Nadab, took over his place, right? You look at kingdoms, you look at governments all around this world, and God is still just as much in control of who's reigning and who's ruling now as what he was then. And you say, well, there's wicked leaders. There's wicked leaders then. But God has a way of working out all things together for his good and for his purposes. regardless of what nation, what kingdom it's in. And to us, on the outside looking in, it just looks like the normal process of events. But God has a way in His sovereignty of not interfering with man's free will, but in His sovereignty, making things go according to His will. And so there's a tension between God's sovereignty and man's free will. We're going to see here in a minute, Zimri is going to come and he's going to turn against Elah, the son of Baasha, and he's going to do the same thing to Baasha's son that Baasha did to Jeroboam's son. Okay? But God did not make Baasha or Zimri do either of these things, but God used their wickedness and their desires to carry out His judgment. And that's about as hard for us to understand and comprehend, this tension between God's sovereignty and man's free will, as trying to explain the Trinity. Right? There's a tension that exists there. Okay, so we got to Baasha's son now. So Nadab, Baasha, we come down to Elah. And it says, in the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Elah, the son of Baasha, to reign over Israel in Tirzah 2 years. Seems like we've already had a ruler that only ruled 2 years, right? And his servant, Zimri, captain of half his chariots, conspired against him as he was in Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, steward of his house in Tirzah. And Zimri went and smote him and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his stead. So God says to Baasha, because of your wickedness, your dynasty's not going to last. Your children are going to die and be left to feed the dogs and the birds. His son Elah becomes king, and within 2 years, he's still got battles going on. He's still got fights that are going on, but he's not participating in them. He's staying at home, and he's drinking himself drunk. And so he has a man that is over half of his chariots that comes into the capital city, sees the king in a drunken stupor, and says, "Here's my chance," and kills the king and announces himself to be king. You see how while Asa was ruling in Judah, things were going good. There was religious reforms going on and things. That in Israel, because they have turned their back on God, they are doing every man that which is right in his own eyes. It's treachery, it's backstabbing, it's wickedness, it's idolatry, it's sin, it's fighting constantly. Right? And I think that's instructive for us as Christians, because whenever we follow after God, whenever we serve Him, we can follow Him, we can serve Him, we can walk in peace. It doesn't mean there'll be no problems. They had their share of problems, but as they were walking with God, God was able to give them peace through the troubles. But with the house of Israel, there was no peace, right? Just constant turmoil, constant distress. Something I told Les before Christmas, we were talking, and we said that we were joking around. We said we are a boring bunch of people. Okay, we said our family is boring, and I told her, I said, honestly, I don't think that it is so much that we're boring, but we're peaceful. We don't have to constantly be entertained. We don't constantly have to be doing this and have stuff going on. Peaceful, and that's fine with me. And so with the northern kingdom, constant turmoil, with the southern kingdom, walking with God, they had peace. And so we need to continue on here. I want to get through these kings tonight. We're almost there. But Elah becomes king. Zimri conspires to kill him whenever he's drunk and kills him, and he's only reigned for 2 years. But we remember that whenever Baasha did this, whenever he staged his coup, whenever he took over, he reigned for, 24 years, right? Zimri doesn't do so well. Zimri doesn't do so well. It came to pass that when he began to reign, as soon as he sat on the throne, that he slew all the house of Baasha and left him not one that pisseth against the wall, neither of his kinfolks nor of his friends. So Zimri, whenever he comes in, he kills everyone. Kills his friends, kills his family, kills them all as soon as he takes the throne. But the crazy thing about it is that he only rules for 1 week. That would have been a busy week. The only thing that Zimri did while he ruled was kill the house of Baasha and all of his friends. So murderous rampage, that was his kingdom. That was his reign. So if you wonder about God's judgment on the wickedness and on the sins of the people of the kings of Israel, you can't really question God's justice or his integrity for allowing judgment to fall on them when you see the type of wickedness they were descending into, right? And so anyway, he killed everyone. Verse 12 of chapter 16, it says, thus did Zimri destroy all the house of Baasha according to the word of the Lord, which he spake against Baasha by Jehu the prophet, for all the sins of Baasha and the sins of Eli his son, which they sinned and by which they made Israel to sin. So notice it said Eli his son was also just as wicked as he was. And by the which they made Israel to sin and provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their vanities. Now the rest of the acts of Eli and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, did Zimri reign 7 days. That is a short reign for a king. But he left a path of destruction behind him. So he reigned 7 days in Tirzah, and the people were encamped against Gibeathon. Remember us talking about Gibeathon earlier? That was 26 years ago, and they're still going at it. So they gave up that little bit whenever they threw the Levites out under Jeroboam. The Philistines are still there. They are still trying to regain that, fighting the same old battles and still not getting victory. And so they were camped against Gibeathon, which belonged to the Philistines. And the people that were encamped heard say, Zimri hath conspired and has slain the king. Wherefore all Israel made Omri, the captain of the host, king over Israel, that day in the camp. So if you can wrap your mind around the history of all this, okay? You have Elah is killed by Zimri. Zimri kills all of Baasha's family and friends, okay? And then Zimri reigns for his 7 days, and that's just long enough for word to get to the battlefield. So the battle was going on. Elah was drunk. He got killed. Zimri became king. Word traveled to the battlefield. And whenever it got to the battlefield, the people said, Zimri is not going to reign. And they put, they put Omri as being the king. He was the head of all of the military. He was the leader of all of the army. Okay. And he was there leading them into battle. He was doing what, honestly, Elah should have been doing. And as soon as they received word, they said, no way, we're not going to allow that traitorous backstabber Zimri to reign. They make Omri the king, and Omri went up and all Israel with him to besiege Tirzah, which was the capital of the northern kingdom. And it came to pass when Zimri saw the city was taken, verse 18, that he went into the palace of the king's house and burnt the king's house over him with fire, and he died. I can't help but in my mind not keep bouncing back and forth from Asa to this mess. From Judah to Israel. Following God, letting the devil have the captain seat. Right? Because that's what's going on here. And so anyway, whenever Omri leads his army away from where they're besieging Gibeathon, comes into the capital city. Zimri says, oh no, I'm in trouble. He sets the palace alight and burns himself alive in the palace that he's inhabited for 7 days, spending that time killing people. This is just, it's insane, isn't it? But this is what happened.
This makes a beautiful movie.
You think so? I mean, honestly, it's so messed up, people probably wouldn't buy it. But I mean, it's just constant treachery back and forth and everything. But it is because they have turned their backs on God. They have forgotten the God of Israel. They were meant to be his people, following him, protected and promoted by him. And instead, every man's doing that which is right in his own eyes. And everything falls into total chaos. And that's what's going on. And so anyway, he burns the palace down. He dies. And we move on to verse number 21. And it says the people are divided into two parts because part of them followed Omri. But then there was other people that followed Tibni. We have no idea who this guy Tibni is, but apparently he was important enough and well-known enough that he had a following. It seems like maybe Omri was a military leader and Tibni was more of a politician or something like that. But either way, now we have a civil war that rages in the Northern Kingdom. Remember, there's already been a civil war between Israel and Judah. Now there's a civil war between Israel and Israel, between Omri and Tibni. And that lasts for 4 years. Because if you compare, Zimri took over in the 27th year of Asa, but it wasn't until the 31st year, verse number 23, that Omri began to reign. So for 4 years, there was civil war in Israel, where there was a fight between which one of these guys are going to be king. And it says in the end of verse number 22, it says, I'll go ahead and read verse 22. But the people that followed Omri prevailed against the people that followed Tibni, the son of Jenath. So Tibni died, and Omri reigned. It doesn't say how he died. Definitely sounds suspicious. I don't think he died of natural causes. Okay? So Tibni died, Omri reigned, and he reigned for 12 years in Tirzah, or 12 years, 6 years reigned he in Tirzah, and he bought the hill of Samaria. Now we come to something interesting. So Omri is reigning. He reigns for 6 years in Tirzah, where the palace has been burnt down. He's surrounded by the ruins of this. Things have went bad for the previous kings for a while. And he decides it's time to relocate. We need a different capital city for Israel. And so he relocates the capital of Israel to a new place. He buys a mountain, a hill, someplace that's going to be defensible. And he buys it of his own money so that the capital city belongs to him and his family after him, trying to further secure his heritage, trying to further secure his dynasty, right? Which is going to continue for about 46 years. His dynasty, not his kingdom, but his dynasty. But it establishes the Northern Kingdom's capital as being Samaria, which it continues being until it's carried away by Assyria. And then in the New Testament, you find that Samaria is then owned not by Israel, but by the Samaritans, which is a mixed breed, half Jew, half Gentile bunch, right? So is everybody following all of that between Old Testament, New Testament, all these different things? This is where Samaria enters the picture, under Omri. And Omri is known to be not just a bad king, but a wicked king, an evil king. Okay? Verse 25, but Omri wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord and did worse than all that were before him. For he walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and his sins wherewith he made Israel to sin to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger with their vanities. So now he's not just causing the people to follow after Jeroboam's religion, but he is also causing them to bring in these vanities, which is idols, Jeroboam's religion, his cows were meant to represent the God of Israel, right? Now they're bringing in ones that don't even represent the God of Israel, just bringing in straight up idolatry. So there's a slippery slope. Jeroboam said, well, we're still worshiping God, but we're going to bring in these images dedicated to God. But now it's like, well, we're bringing in Baal and Ashtoreth and Molech and all the others as well. And so it says that Omri did evil in excess of all the ones that reigned before him. So with each one, they're just getting a little bit worse, a little bit worse, right? And he is just paving the way for the next guy, Ahab. Anyone remember Ahab? Ahab and Jezebel? Which is the most wicked one of all of them up to that point, right? And so they continue getting worse and worse. But anyway, whenever we look at Omri here, history tells us quite a bit about Omri, actually. The Bible doesn't say much at all about him because it is recording the fall of Israel. It's recording them continuing to get more and more and more wicked, further and further away from God. So it's not recording their positive things, the good things that they did by man's standards. But if you go back in the history books, there is plenty of evidence of Omri and his kingdom and the things that exist. There's things within archaeology that relate back to him. As a matter of fact, history tells us that Omri led in a conquest against the Moabites. Remember the Moabites, right? So he led battles against the Moabites. He subdued the Moabites. And the Moabites were under the control of Israel for a couple kings. We find in 2 Kings chapter number 1, the Moabites rebel. But under the time of Ahab and under the time of Omri, they were subject unto Israel. Not only that, but Omri had gained a lot of prestige and a lot of power and a good reputation amongst the heathen kings that were around him, so much so that they referred to Israel as being the house of Omri. That's what history tells us about it. So there are places in history where there are writings outside of God's people where they refer to God's people as the house of Omri. So that tells us that wicked King Omri, that was more wicked than all the kings before him, fought, did battle, gained victories, gained wealth, gained power, gained a reputation in that area. But what does God have to say about him? We say, well, the wicked never prosper. Sometimes they do, and we see that in our own lives, right? But at the end of all of it, it doesn't matter what the world has to say about him. It doesn't matter what is written in the history books. It doesn't matter the lands he conquered or the wealth that he amassed. Whenever it comes to God, God says he wrought evil, he did wrong, he was a wicked king. So whenever we look in this world in which we live in, there are plenty of people who might build a name for themselves. They may build up their own dynasty. They may have great successes and accomplishments, and the world may shout their praises. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what history has to say about them. Doesn't matter what the world has to say about them. It only matters what does God have to say about it. And there are many people that are going to stand before God one of these days, and he's going to say, depart from me, ye that work in iniquity. I never knew you. And at that moment, it's not going to matter how big of a kingdom they had, how much money they had in the bank, what kind of a car they drove, what kind of house they lived in. It's not going to matter what their title was or how much they earned. None of those things are going to matter, because if they don't know God and God doesn't know them, the rest of it is worthless. And so whenever history remembers Omri, they may have good things to say about him, but in God's word, God has nothing good to say about him. And so far be it from me to have a good name in this world, but not to have a good name with God. I want to please him, not man. And so whenever we come down to all of this, we see that Omri reigned. He did evil. Reigned for 12 years. In verse number 28, he slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria. And Ahab, his son, reigned in his stead. And that was in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Ahab, the son of Omri, to reign over Israel. And so we find here that there was a constant decline in Israel. It continued to get more and more wicked with each king, with each generation. And we now arrive at the most wicked of them all, Ahab. And so 1 Kings kind of takes a bit of a turn whenever we arrive at Ahab, because God has been dealing with the kings, right? He's been dealing with the kings. He's been sending prophets to the kings, trying to get the kings to turn. But as the kings have been devolving into more and more wickedness, they've been dragging the people along with them. But the kings are kind of past the point of no return, and God is going to begin sending prophets, not to the kings, but he's going to begin sending prophets to the people, because the kings won't listen, right? And it shows us God's mercy, because God did try to turn them around. God did try to correct them. But whenever the kings got so hard-hearted toward God, so angry toward him and resistant toward him and so far in idolatry, God then sends Elijah and Elisha to minister amongst the people as well as to the kings, because God still cares about the people. He still wants to see them turn around. He still wants to see them get right with him. And so in judgment, in the midst of all their wickedness and all these things, God is still extending mercy to them, right? And so, Lord willing, next week what we're going to be looking at is Ahab's kingdom and the part that Elijah plays in it. I know our focus all along has been mostly on the kings. It's been our study is the kings of Israel. But we're going to get into Elijah and Elisha as well, just because I think they play too big of a part to ignore them. Okay? So just the final thought on all of this. 5 or 6 bad kings in succession, completely against God, chaos, backstabbing, constant fighting and bloodshed amongst the people who have forsaken God. On the other side, you have Asa and the people of Judah having a revival and seeking after God. Relative peace, seeing success, seeing victory. Huge difference between Asa's 41 years and all this mess we went over tonight, right? And so our lesson from all this is to continue to seek God, pursue him, follow his will, because this world and the devil has nothing to offer us. May paint a pretty picture, but behind that pretty picture is destruction. So does anyone have anything to add, any questions, comments? Kind of apologize. I realize now looking back over this has been kind of depressing, hasn't it? Like just a slow burn throughout all of this.
Two questions. I would ask one. I think it's mentioned almost twice in the study we are doing. The anger of God.
Mm-hmm.
I think in these kings, things that they were doing, it provoked God.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the words that are mentioned in two chapters, first one and second one, I think it's 25th, and then whatever back. How does God get angry as God? And if so, it's mentioned there, he gets angry.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, to what extent that the anger of God comes down? Because it seems when they're angry,
mm-hmm.
there is things that are the happening.
Okay. Just the easiest way that I can explain this is we have a hard time understanding God being angry because typically all the times that we see anger, it is in a bad sense.
Yes.
Because you get angry and it leads to sin. The Bible talks about anger and sin not.
Yeah.
But most of the cases that we see of anger, it's excess. Mm-hmm. It is an outburst of emotions that leads us to do things that we shouldn't do. But anger has a place. Everything that God created is for a purpose, but man and sin has a way of corrupting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at, like, whenever Jesus came into the temple and he overthrew the tables and those kind of things, and we think of it as being, you know, someone losing control. God doesn't lose control. Even in his anger, he is still well within control, and he is doing things for a purpose and for a point. And so whenever Jesus came there, that was the house of God. That was his place. It was where he had made. It was supposed to be a place where mankind could meet with him, and the religious leaders had turned it into a place to enrich themselves. And so whenever Jesus came through and he cleansed it, the source of his anger was that the people of Israel were being misled and they were being mistreated. And so he was throwing out the ones who were oppressing and who were hurting. So to bring that into something that we could relate to, if you come home one day and say that your daughter has moved here, she's living in your apartment, and you come home and there is someone who has broke into your home where your daughter is at and is threatening her, are you going to be angry?
Right.
Are you going to be righteous in that anger? Or are you going to be just in being angry?
Okay. You're angry to who? To her or to someone who broke in? To get a question.
Okay. So she's there and someone breaks in and they are a threat to her and you come in and find that. You're going to be angry, right?
Definitely. Yes. And
okay. And you are right in being angry. Because if you just walk in like, oh, I guess this is what's going on now, and you just be like, okay, there's something wrong with Peter. You should be angry in that because someone is being abused, someone's being hurt, someone that you love. And so because of that, you are going to respond in anger. But unfortunately, generally, we respond in an excess. God's anger is not excessive. It is just and righteous and holy. And that's the part that we have trouble comprehending because it is beyond our ability. We lose control when we get angry. God doesn't lose control when he gets angry. And generally, whenever we see God getting angry, it is whenever people are abusing his people, whenever people are misleading his people. And his anger is generally directed at those who are corrupting, doing wickedly, abusing, oppressing, that kind of thing. And so his anger allows him to mete out the appropriate judgment and justice. And so we talk about the wrath of God being released. And we think about wrath being, you know, red-faced and lose control, right? But God's wrath is his judgment being meted out against those who have done wickedly.
But again, but when he released the wrath, there is an action that is done. Because to this study, this king, Jeroboam, whatever, I can't pronounce his name, he led Israel out of God's will, per se. And then, based on that, within prophecy, if I can relate well, it led him even to his own lineage to get perished. That's the provocation he made to God, and God's response to his anger per se. And that will bring me to the next question, which I suppose not to ask, but I will have to ask.
Okay.
When does God, because it seems to me, to, just as you say, it's difficult as with my small brain to comprehend God mm-hmm. is brain is huge. Mm-hmm. To what extent, or I don't know how to put this question, well, to what extent or in which way God take responsibility in his own actions, not action, but on his own judgment.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Because, okay, I will give you an example within Job.
Mm-hmm.
It seems Satan was somewhere, wherever God mm-hmm. can see.
Mm-hmm.
And to my understanding, if I can read well, it's God who start conversation with Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And God asked Satan, did you see my faithful person, whatever
mm-hmm.
Job?
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation started. So the question is, when does God start conversation with Satan and allow him a chance or give him possibility to go tempt Job's?
Mm-hmm.
And when that God, that's the question, when does God get that full credit of all this conversation and open the way
mm-hmm.
for Satan to come in?
Okay. Well, in the book of Job, it says that there was a day whenever the sons of God came and basically gave an account.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that, it was God as being the supreme control of being the king of all creation was in control of all of creation. And so all of these created beings were accountable to him, including Satan.
Yeah.
And so Satan is not an equal opposite of God or an equal opposite of Jesus. He is a created being that has no power except for what God allows.
Yeah.
And God allows Satan a bit of realm of operation for his purposes. His purposes is to give mankind a choice. And so mankind under Adam chose to listen to Satan instead of to God. And God still allows Satan to operate in that realm of giving man a choice of whether they're going to listen to God or listen to Satan. But God still holds him within strict limitations, and he can't go beyond what God allows him to do. Only what God allows him to do to work together to his purpose, his plan, to according to his will. So if we think in our minds that Satan has like this unlimited power, he doesn't. God has him there for a purpose and a reason that we are not going to be able to comprehend. But Satan gives an account, and to work out God's purpose and God's plan, God allowed Satan to oppress Job, but it ended up being for Job's good. And it was an extreme case, but it was for our instruction, because Job went through a time of testing and trial, and through it, he learned about God, he depended on God more, and at the end, he had a better understanding of God, a complete trust and faith in God, and God prospered him in the end. So in the end, even though he went through a difficult situation, a hard time, he was better afterward. So for us, where we go through a time of trial or difficulty, you go through a sickness or go through a relationship issue, you go through a divorce, something like that, it's not necessarily that God caused it, but God may have allowed it for your refining, for your growth, and so that you could see him work more in your life, you could more fully depend on him, and that he could bring ultimate blessing as a result of it. And once again, that's the ways of God, and it's hard for us to wrap our heads around. How can God use something like loss and sickness, such as in Job's situation, how can he use that to bring about good? Well, in the end, Job had a fear, reverence of God. He had a better understanding of how God operates. He had a great faith that God was in control and knew what he was doing. And on top of that, he had more than he started with. So God kind of blessed him for his faithfulness through the trial. And on a bigger picture than that, we have that story. Job went through all of that so that we would have that story so that we could remain faithful through our trials, understanding that God was in control, that he will not allow us to be tempted above that which we are able, right? and that he's going to end up carrying us through. He'll take care of us, and Satan is no match for him. So I'm not sure if I answered your question or not, but...
Those are the dots.
I guess both questions you ask, it comes down to the fact that God is just so much bigger than we can comprehend, and that he knows what he's doing, even if it doesn't make sense to us.
That's the main point.
I've heard it said this way, that if we knew what God knows, we would do things just as God does.
Yes.
But because of the limit of our knowledge and our understanding, we question God. But if we had the knowledge that God has, we would do things just the same way as he does it. Anything else?
No.
Okay. Well, if there's nothing else, let's go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer and we'll call it a night. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your blessings. We thank you for this time that we've had in your word and for the instruction from it. Lord, we just pray, Lord, ask you just to help us to take these bad examples and to learn from them. And Lord, we see what a mess it is that these guys continuing to delve into evil and to reject you and to follow after their own desires in their hearts and how it all came apart. I just pray, Lord, that you just help us, Lord, to trust and to follow you as imperfectly as we do, that we keep our eyes on you, trusting you, that you do all things well, and that you know what you're doing. We thank you, and we do love you, and we praise you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.